Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri, and we're on a whirlwind adventure this morning. From a start at the Supreme Court, we'll head up Mount Washington on the Cog Railway. Then we traverse the state with Rusty DeWeese and follow it up to see narwhals in the Arctic with a conservation photographer. But let's start in the judicial branch. Last week, after over 27 years on the Supreme Court, Bill Clinton-nominated Stephen Breyer announced that he was retiring. He's 83 years old. Before serving on the Supreme Court, he had been nominated by Jimmy Carter in 1980 to the first U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. That includes Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Puerto Rico. As President Joe Biden is presented with his first opportunity to nominate a Supreme Court justice, we're going to discuss Justice Breyer, his legacy, and possible nominees to replace him. Here to do that is Vermont Law School Professor Jared Carter. Professor Carter, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Great. Happy to be here, although I will say it sounds a little bit more interesting to go hang out with narwhals than talk about the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, we'll be the judge of that. You usually make this quite interesting.
All right. And, I'll try to loop narwhals into the conversation.
If you could, that'd be great. I love the narwhal. Listeners, if you want to ask Professor Carter about the Supreme Court nomination or narwhals, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jared, what does stand out about the career of Stephen Breyer?
You know, I think a couple of things. Number one, his sense of the importance of the judiciary, the independence of the judiciary. And number two, I think what I've always been impressed with about Justice Breyer is his ability to work to bring unity to the court. And I think that's really, really important and perhaps overlooked today in a court that is oftentimes very politicized by the media and by the general public, because what that means is that the court's more often able to speak with one voice or with a greater majority in support. And so I think he was a behind-the-scenes unifier in many respects. And I'll share one quick story, if I could.
Yeah, please.
About a time I took a group of Vermont Law School students down to the court to watch an argument that we were studying. We all saw Justice Breyer was very lively, asking a lot of questions. But I also saw him passing notes back and forth with the now deceased Justice Scalia. And the reason I tell that story is because I think it's emblematic of what Justice Breyer was like. Those two were completely diametrically opposed in terms of their judicial philosophy, but they were joking and passing notes back and forth during an oral argument. And I think it showed his ability to connect regardless of politics and that unifying influence that I think is so important on the court.
Well, he was one of the three liberal judges on the court. How liberal have his decisions or opinions been?
Well, I think it's all a matter of one's perspective, but I think that's right. He has been in the progressive wing. He was there in that wing when it came to upholding Obamacare on abortion rights and on a series of other sort of major issue cases. I think he isn't known for having drafted necessarily a lot of the very important decisions. But as I said, I think his work was often behind the scenes and making sure that the court could come to some sort of agreement, if not consensus, then a larger majority than would otherwise been the case.
And then have there been any decisions that he's made during his time, any ways he's voted on the Supreme Court that were a surprise, or was he always consistently to the left?
I think he was consistently in the progressive left of the court. I think what I would point to, though, was his ability to connect with other members of the court despite their perhaps different judicial philosophies. And I think it's important to remember, and I think this is important for listeners to think about and understand, that yes, we do tend to talk these days about, one justice on the left, one justice on the right. And look, these folks are human beings. There's no way they can remove themselves from their world of experiences. But I think to a T, the members of the court try to apply the law as they see it. And I think of it more as a difference of judicial philosophy than necessarily pure politics.
Mm. That's an excellent point, Jared, and thank you for pointing that out. Was his decision to retire his own, or might he have been pressured to do so to allow President Biden to fill the position, especially while the Democrats have the opportunity before the midterm elections?
Well, look, I think there's a reason why Supreme Court justices have lifetime appointments once they get through the process, and it's to insulate them from the day-to-day politics. Yeah. And so I think that's an important point to make in starting to answer that question. But I think we also need to be realistic. The Democrats who are in control of the Senate and obviously the executive, the presidency right now, were saddened, of course, by the passing of Justice Ginsburg. But it also meant that former President Trump got to fill what was a consistently, quote unquote, liberal justice position. And so I think they're cognizant of that now. And I think Justice Breyer certainly, doesn't live in the sand. He understands the reality of the situation. And so I think that the timing is not coincidental, to my mind, even if they don't come out and directly acknowledge that reality.
And how important, with a 6-3 minority, is it to replace a liberal justice with a liberal justice? Does it make any difference?
I think certainly, broadly speaking, the answer is no. This isn't going to shift the court the way the appointments that President Trump made did.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you pointed out, there's already a supermajority in this one particular more right-leaning judicial philosophy space. And truthfully, I think this may even continue to drift the court to the right, quote-unquote, because, it's got to get through the Senate, whoever the person is. And, I don't know that the person that's ultimately going to move through the Senate is going to be as far to the left, so to speak, as Justice Breyer was.
Sure.
So I don't think it's going to make a major difference. I think the big thing will be, to me, what sort of role can this person play behind the scenes in terms of building consensus, building relationships with other members of the court, because it doesn't change the pure numbers in terms of votes.
And explain that part, Jared. That I think that's really important for us to understand who don't watch the Supreme Court that closely. That behind-the-scenes work that is done by a justice and why that's important.
Absolutely. Look, here's why, and I totally understand why people don't, necessarily follow the Supreme Court with bated breath. There's a lot of legalese, and certainly people, rightfully can be turned off by that. But the important thing to remember is that in the end, it's the U.S. Supreme Court that protects, in many respects, the rule of law.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because they have a military they can send out or a police force they can send out to enforce their decisions. It's because we as a society accept that even if we disagree with their holding, that is the rule of law. And I think it's really, really important to reflect on that in these times of, the politicization of the court and this hyperpolarization that we have, that really is an important piece. And within that, when the justices are making decisions about how to rule, how to vote on a particular matter, there's often back and forth. One justice might draft an opinion, they circulate that with other members of the court, and other members of the court say, well, here's how I think it should be changed, or if we don't do this, I'm going to dissent. And there's a whole process that's going on that, quite frankly, the public can't see and doesn't see, but that is really important to the court speaking with as unified of a voice as it can. And I think in the end, that's really, really important to have somebody that can approach it in an apolitical way that clearly we aren't seeing in Congress and clearly we aren't seeing in our day-to-day politics.
I'm going to ask you one more political question about this and then move on. But if Breyer's retirement had happened after the midterm elections when there could be a shift in power. How difficult might it have been for this nominee to get approved? Or, you know, would President Biden have really gone very moderate with his selection?
Well, I think, you know, I think President Biden's probably still going to be fairly moderate in some senses. I mean, the list of folks that are sort of talked about as the leading contenders are certainly not, you know, far left judges or justices.
Right.
Because remember, he's still got to unify the Democrats. They,
right.
They've got a very slim majority with Vice President Harris casting the deciding vote. So I don't think he can go too far to the left even now. But look, if this had happened after the midterms, and this is why I think we've got to be practical. I think Breyer, the president, all are very aware of this. I think it potentially means that he doesn't get a nominee through, a la Merrick Garland, which folks might remember was President Obama's nominee towards the end of his term, and Senator McConnell essentially sat on that and said, we're not holding hearings.
Right.
So, you know, it's now or never, particularly if the Democrats aren't able to control the Senate.
Let's go to Newbury. We've got Fred on the line. Morning, Fred.
Morning. Hey, this is interesting. If my ninth grade history is correct, or I remember my ninth grade history, there is absolutely no constitutional restrictions as far as the Supreme Court is considered. So basically that means I can be a Supreme Court justice
That's
as well
right.
as you can.
Yep.
So the problem is, this is the problem. The Supreme Court has become so political because of two major reasons. The president appoints somebody and the Senate approves it. So the Supreme Court is a political institution, and I should be able to vote for Supreme Court justices just like everybody else.
Well, Fred, Fred, good points. Let's take Fred's first because, Jared, you know, you don't necessarily have to be a judge, have correct? There's no particular credentials required to become a Supreme Court justice. Fred, right about that?
He's absolutely right about that. And he raises a very interesting point about the process by which members of the court are selected. And I think, to my mind, on the one hand, he's very right. It is a political process. The president is obviously a political being, and the Senate is a political body. So in some ways, there's no way to eliminate politics. And I don't know that voting does that either. It's just the nature of our society. And so I think, you know, to my mind, while I certainly understand the democratic impulses, the way you insulate the process from pure day-to-day politics is not having a vote. Now, look, there are many states, actually, and this is sort of surprising for folks perhaps from New England,
yeah.
But many states actually do elect their state Supreme Courts and judges across the country. In fact, I think it's a majority. And they obviously function fine as a general rule. But I think what the founders intended and the reason that it's set up the way it is to try to, as much as possible, insulate justices from day-to-day politics. And you could certainly make the argument, and I think this is what the founders thought when they drafted this part of the Constitution, that if a justice was always worried about getting reelected every 4 years or 6 years, that they might make decisions based on popular will.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to protecting a particular constitutional right. So I think that's an important point. And then the other sort of piece to my response is that in some ways we do get to vote. Elections have consequences.
Right.
And so when we vote for president or when we vote for our U.S. senators, we should take into account what's their philosophy of judicial appointments and how that process should play out. That's our chance to have our political voice heard. But I take Fred's
Absolutely.
Point, and I think it's an interesting one. And as I said, many states have decided to do exactly what he said with their state Supreme Courts.
Well, this is the fourth time in 5 years that we're seeing a justice replaced. So, Jared, first of all, is that a bit unprecedented? And secondly, has it given Americans a better sense of the importance of these appointments and the importance of their vote?
Yeah, I think it absolutely has. I think it is unprecedented in many respects. To my mind, I can't think of any instances where there's been this much turnover at the court in its history. I can't say for sure. I'm not a judicial Supreme Court historian, but I think it's pretty unprecedented, certainly in modern times, to have this much change. And I think that's part of the reason it's become so political is because people are seeing how that change has real-world effects on the Constitution, on the laws of the land. And I think there's drawbacks to that, certainly, to have the court more and more politicized. And I don't think that's going away anytime soon. But I do think as younger members of the court come on board, and certainly the top of the list for Biden are younger judges as well, then we'll probably see less turnover over time. And maybe we can settle back down to how things used to be, where Supreme Court nominations weren't drop-dead political battles, and we can depoliticize to the extent possible the court, because I think that's really important for our constitutional democracy.
Now, President Biden has indicated that he's going to nominate an African-American woman for the spot on the bench. How's this being met by Republicans in the Senate and by U.S. voters overall?
Well, they've certainly begun, I think, on both sides of the political spectrum, making this a midterm election issue. Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham, I think as soon as Justice Breyer announced his retirement, you know, shot out a press release saying, you know, elections matter. Here's the evidence. The Democrats are going to get to appoint a justice. So I think this is going to be a major political issue over the course of the coming months. And, you know, that's the nature of the beast. But in the end, I think if you look at the people who are at the very top of Biden's list, some of them have gotten bipartisan support. They're sitting currently as federal judges and, in fact, garnered Republican support. So I wouldn't be surprised at all to see Biden try to do that again and pick one of these people who have been through the Senate as nominees for lower courts. Because I think that sends a powerful message if there is bipartisan support the way there used to be. I mean, it used to be that judge justices were appointed with supermajorities. I don't remember the exact vote, but I think Breyer, you know, garnered certainly a supermajority of Senate support when he was nominated. So, you know, I think getting back to that would be good for the court, good for the rule of law.
Yeah. From what you can tell, who are the front runners for the nomination right now?
Well, as I think you said, Biden's indicated that he plans to nominate an African-American woman. And so when you look at that list, the ones that float to the top, there's a federal judge who was actually Biden's first pick for the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the federal appeals court in the District of Columbia, and which is often sort of a stepping stone or a place where judges go on their way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's Judge Brown Jackson, who is one of the ones who got three Republican votes in the Senate when she was nominated. So I think she's an odds-on favorite. You've also got a woman who's a justice on the California Supreme Court, Justice Kruger. You know, she's 45 years old, so again, lifetime appointments. They're certainly looking towards that. There's another D.C. Circuit nominee that Biden made, Judge Childs, who I think is also sort of in that lane. In fact, Lindsey Graham, I think, also heaps praise on Judge Childs, and he's a leader in the Senate on the Republican side. So I think those are sort of the three top picks that come to mind at this point.
Now, we mentioned earlier with Fred's call that the nominee does not have to be a judge. So is there any chance that he'd reach out to someone like maybe Vice President Kamala Harris or former First Lady Michelle Obama?
Well, people have floated Kamala Harris's name around. I don't personally think she's at the top of the list. I think that becomes pretty political if you were to nominate her. And as I said, I think Biden's instincts are to tamp down the politics, even if that is, you know, an impossible endeavor in many respects. So I think it's unlikely to be her, but people have mentioned that. And certainly Michelle Obama is an attorney, and there's a long relationship there as well. But I also think that would invoke all sorts of political issues as well. So I still think odds are it's going to be one of these three or four judges or justices that that I mentioned a moment ago.
Jared, how important is it that President Joe Biden get this right, get this nomination right?
It's absolutely critical because if you look at the issues that the U.S. Supreme Court deals with year to year, these are the major issues of our time. This term, for example, the court's considering abortion case. The court's considering a Second Amendment gun rights case, a First Amendment separation of church and state case, a state secrets case dealing with torture. It's got death penalty cases on its docket. I mean, these are the most important legal and constitutional issues that our society faces. So it's incredibly important that any president get it right. And that obviously means different things to different people. But, you know, in many respects, these nine justices wield incredible power and influence over our society and the rule of law.
We have about a minute left. We keep talking about, you know, getting support even from the GOP on this. But will he face some of the hurdles on the Democratic side that he has with passing budget items from Senator Manchin, from Senator Sinema?
I think, you know, look, there's definitely a difference between passing a law and nominating a justice. Mm-hmm. But I think he's got to be cognizant of those two in particular as centrist Democrats. And that's why I think he's not going to stray too far to the left in terms of nominating somebody, because if he loses them, you know, the show's over.
Right.
So I think he's going to hew to the center. I think the people that he's talking about fit that bill. And I think that's in large part because of the senators like Sinema and Manchin out of West Virginia.
Jared Carter is a professor at Vermont Law School. Professor Carter, always a pleasure having you join us. Thank you so much.
Yeah, glad to be here, and good luck with the narwhals.
All right. I'll give you a call if I need your help with them. All right, we're going to take a break for a CBS News update and then come back to take a trip up Mount Washington on the Cog Railway. And coming up today at 1 o'clock, 3 full hours of The Getaway. Then tonight at 7, more music as we present Jazz with George Thomas. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I really don't make a bucket list. If I get it in my head to do something, I usually just go do it. But ever since I've arrived at the North Country and heard about the Mount Washington Cog Railway, I always thought, this is calling me. And yet, I have yet to make the trek up the mountain. They seem to forget about it at the right time of year. But now, it's running in the winter as well. Like right now, every day. Dude, what am I waiting for? Joining me now to further excite me about the prospect of heading up Mount Washington on the Cog is their director of marketing, Rob Airy. Rob, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you have a question about the Cog Railway or if you want to share your experience, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can rub it in my face that you've been up and I haven't. But Rob, first, what is a Cog Railway?
Well, I mean, basically, if you think of a spoke and chain that you'd use on a bicycle, that's basically what it is. So we laid out the chain all the way up the mountain, and that helps us propel the train up the side of Mount Washington.
Is it one chain? Is it many chains? What happens if a chain
breaks?
Well,
no, it's not really a chain. So it's it's a rack that looks like a bike chain laid all the way out up 3 miles up the mountain. And then the spokes, we have two spokes in the, or two cogs really, on the passenger car and two on the engine. And they basically work right as a in the cog and bring you right up the mountain.
Hmm. When and why was it originally built?
Tourism was always the main purpose. So Sylvester Marsh, our founder, came up here after having some health problems in 1866 and climbed Mount Washington, barely made it to the summit and decided there's got to be an easier way. And through working with legislators and everything else, he made a railway to the moon, is basically was the joke.
Was there anything up there, just the summit, or was there any kind of destination at any point?
The auto road opened, the Mount Washington auto road opened a little bit before us on the other side of the mountain. But yeah, there really wasn't much up there at that point, just probably a shelter of some kind.
Mm-hmm. And why a cog railway?
Well, because a regular train wouldn't get any traction or any way to get up the side of a mountain. So by having the spoke in the cog, it is able to pull you right up the mountain.
Mm. What did P.T. Barnum think when he rode the cog?
He said we were the second greatest attraction, top wonder of the world. The second greatest show on earth is his exact words.
Oh, I love it. All right, let's take a call. Rob is joining us from Montpelier. Rob, go right ahead.
Yeah, I just had a question. Can you, get on the cog and get a ticket and get your skis and go and ski the snowfields on Mount Washington there?
Oh, great question. Well,
yeah, so right now we're only going about one-third of the way up. If you wanted to buy, it's right now currently we're not offering a one-way ticket, but you are absolutely welcome to take a ride up and then ski down. One of the new things that we got going on, and once we get enough snow, we'll bring it into use, is we bought a snowcat with a 10-person thing on the back, and basically we are planning on running some backcountry tours up to the top of the mountain as well. But we haven't quite figured that out yet. We haven't had enough snow to really get it to work.
All right. Rob from Montpelier, which would you prefer, just going up part of the way and skiing down, or riding with the cat and coming all the way down?
I kind of like no motorized anything. I just like the peace and quiet of the outdoors. That's my preference. Nice.
Gotcha. Thanks,
Thank
Rob.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go next to Forbes. Hi, Forbes. What's going on?
Hi. How are you?
Good.
A number of years ago, I had the fortunate time to be able to go over there, and I was just looking around the base part, and I met the owner at that particular time, which name is Presby. And I asked him about the car railroad and history of it and everything else, and he spent the whole morning with me, took me over to a machine shop and foundry, which actually manufactured all of the replacement parts for the Carg Railroad, because you couldn't buy that material anywhere.
Right.
And he had one of the few permits for soft coal at that particular time, because that's what fired the boiler. And it was quite an experience, but I went all the way on up through.
Yeah.
And at the top, there's a government experimental station, there was.
Yeah.
Which tests fuels and oils and various other things under inclement weather. Mm. So it's quite a lot of history there, but that was a great experience.
Yeah, Forbes, thanks for that. Rob, let's go through some of those things that Forbes experienced. I think you still do have that machine shop and still are having to build your own parts. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually last year we opened up a brand new maintenance facility, but that original one is still here. Now we can do everything all under one roof. In past years, we've actually had to take all our whole new biodiesel fleet up to Berlin and work in up there. Now we can all do it here inside. We actually have a plasma cutter so we can cut our own parts. We're trying to stay ahead of technology. So absolutely, when it comes to that, there is quite a bit of a history here, and we're building on it.
And also, is the testing center still up there? Do you go up to the Mount Washington Weather Observatory? Where do those things fit in?
Sure. So back in World War II, when they were working on jet engines, the military set up a testing site up there. Both they were working on with commercial airlines to figure out icing on de-icing planes and icing planes, and then also working on jet engines, and obviously how you know, the different fuels work in different temperatures. There's still a pad up there that they use, but none of that is still, none of that's still there really. And then in the summertime, basically May through October, we do go to the summit, where the Mount Washington Observatory in New Hampshire State Park, Mount Washington State Park are up there as well. Yes.
Incredible. And then he mentioned soft coal. I think you use two different types of fuel at different types of years, different type of year, different times of year, to get, up there with the COG. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, our history is really based on steam power. So back when we first opened, you couldn't get coal up here yet, over 150 years ago. So it was wood-fired steam. Then we switched to coal-fired steam, which we ran. Basically, we still do run all the way. Now it's a little bit more of a novelty, though. We run it twice a day during the summertime, basically at the beginning and end of our schedule, since it is a little slower and a little it's all on its own time schedule, basically. And then starting in 2008, we started adding biodiesels to our fleet.
Mm. Now, speaking of times, how often does the COG Railway run up and down the mountain?
In the winter now, we're somewhere between 3 and 5 times a day, depending on the demand. Weekends, we're up to more about 5 times a day to go up to what we call Wombeck Station. And then in the summertime, we run hourly. Basically, anything from 9 to 3 is about the normal schedule.
Have you always run in the winter, Rob, or is this a new thing, or it has been, you know, reinstituted? What's the story?
Well, like Rob was saying, your first caller there, we used to run ski trains. We did that for many years, but it just didn't quite work out. We actually had snowmaking and everything on the side of the trail. But, you know, a steam locomotive in the wintertime, keeping that steam going, and then using that as your lift got a little slow, and it was a little bit boring for people to have to wait for that train. So that ended. So it was over 10 years since we last ran in the winter, but the biodiesels make it much easier for us to go all winter long.
What's the ride like in the winter compared to other times of the year?
Well, when we run to the summit, it's a 3-hour round trip. So you get about an hour to get up the mountain, give you about an hour on the summit, and just under an hour to come back down. In the wintertime, it's about half the cost, and it's only about a 1-hour round trip. So really, you're only on the train about 15, 20 minutes each way. We give you about 20 minutes up there where we have warming huts and open fires so you can cook some marshmallows and really still get a good portion of the view.
And let's talk about the weather, Rob. How should we dress to ride the COG in the winter? I mean, how bad is it? But also, I want to talk to one thing we haven't talked about is what that view is like, too, in the winter. So address those two items.
Sure. So obviously, you're going to want to dress that you're going up the side of Mount Washington. So we are we do stay under the tree line on this trip. So usually the wind isn't horrible, and usually we're low enough on the mountain that we're not getting some of the severe weather you get on top.
Yeah.
But obviously the temperature is right there, so you definitely want to be ready for warmth. Absolutely, you're definitely going to want extra layers and be ready for cold. And then the view, you're looking out over the out over the Mount Washington Hotel and all the way down through the Twin Mountains and that type of stuff. So you got some awesome, awesome views of the Presidential Range.
Rob, it says on your website that you run daily in the winter. What about when you get a couple feet of snow?
Well, so really the only thing that closes us down in the winter is if the roads are impassable to get here. We have a ton of technology in here. We have a huge snow blower that we can keep the tracks clean. And really, there isn't anything that keeps the railroad from running, but if you can't get here, then we do close.
Oh, no kidding. So do the tracks get icy? Would that be a deterrent? Or, again, can you just kind of take care of that?
Yeah, no, we keep track of that. And honestly, with the COG system, as long as the rack stays clear of snow and our snow blower can do that, we can run, no problem.
I love it. And let's talk about the routes again. I think there's just one in the winter, but three different ones. Distances up the mountain you go as the weather gets warmer through the season?
Yeah, so basically, you know, we're obviously known for running to the summit, that three-hour round trip, and then in between our winter operation and our summer operation or main operation, we run to just over treeline, what we call skyline, which is just for a couple weeks a year. That gets you up there really up high on the mountain, but keeps us just below where the winds and terrible weather would affect us more often.
Rob, have you ever driven the train?
I have not. I ride in the engine a lot, but I have never driven it.
When did you ride the Cog for the first time? Do you remember it?
Oh, wow. I don't. I know my parents told me when I was very young I had done it. It's a funny story that I actually came up and ran it a week before I knew that I was going to be taking this job. And that was a few years ago.
How many times do you think you've ridden the Cog?
Oh, in the last few years, I bet I'm close to 20 times.
Oh, man, I'm really jealous.
It's a perk of the job. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, and is there, like, the best time of day to hop it? You know, is there something you recommend to people if they're coming up and you say, oh, wait, go at magic hour or go at this time?
There really isn't. You know, just like most people, the middle of the day, our schedule really gets full and jam-packed. But if you came a little later, especially in the late fall, you can get some pretty awesome sunsets on the way down as well.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that sounds great, too. All right. Now, tell us about, I think you've got an internship program that you've instituted with local schools.
Yeah, with our brand new shop. Basically, like I said, we're keeping it cutting edge. Since we build everything here for both the biodiesels and the steam engines, we've reached out to the local colleges to start an internship so that we can really try to keep some of this talent locally. It's a really neat opportunity, and it's something we're really excited about.
What kind of experience do they get there?
Well, basically anything in a machine shop, so everything from working on diesel engines to using our new plasma cutters and all the all the different types of technology that's just starting to come in, so that it really gives them that hands-on that they may not get at the college.
Rob, how important is the Cog to the local economy there?
Oh, I think being one of the premier attractions here in the state, I would say we're very important. We do have the Mount Washington Hotel just below us, so they're a nice draw. But when it comes for attractions, and especially now that we're year-round, I think we keep a lot of hotels full.
In a typical year, how many people ride the Cog?
We're over 100,000 people a year.
Wow. Oh, that's a lot of people coming to that part of the state.
It sure is, absolutely.
Now, tell us about the trackside service trail. Who can use it, what it's used for?
So basically, if you're hiking using our property, basically, we ask that you pay for a land use permit. And that's really open for anybody. It gives you access to being, using our parking lots, getting you into a warm building that's open early in the morning if you're going to be hiking or skiing down. So it's really open for anybody.
Yeah. Now, a lot of people head over there as well for the Race the Cog in June. Tell us about that.
This is something brand new, so we're not really even sure a lot about it yet.
No.
Yeah, it's a brand new thing. We haven't seen it work yet. We're just basically the hosts for it. But basically, elite runners will be racing the Cog up the side of the tracks in a running race. So, it's going to be an interesting, fun day, that's for sure.
Oh, man. So, all right, let's talk about the logistics of that. First of all, how fast does the Cog actually go? How fast do you have to go to beat the Cog up the mountain?
The biodiesels average just around 5 miles per hour.
All right. And how long will somebody be racing it? How long to the summit?
Well, it takes just about an hour to get to the summit. So they're going to be that's what they're aiming for, is to be probably just around 45 minutes to beat the Cog.
Oh, man. And do you know what the distance is that they'll be racing?
Just about 3 miles.
3 miles. Okay. So about a 5K, you get normally, a good runner can do that in, 15 minutes, 20 minutes? But they're going a pretty steep incline, right?
Yep, and once you get near the summit, the path really becomes very gravel, very, very rocky. You know, not very flat.
All right, and you don't have the cogs to help you like the railway does.
That's for sure. That's for sure. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. When is it in June?
June 25th.
All right, and how do people register to be able to race the cog?
If you go to our website, we have a link. So if you go to thecog.com, you can find a link to the ultramarathoners website that is putting that race on.
All right. I take it you're going to watch that one.
Maybe from the railway itself. I'll drive a train.
All right. What is the reaction when people get off the cog for the first time? What are the things you hear from people?
I just think you really, you've done so much elevation climb in a train that it's pretty breathtaking too. So, you know, either when you get to the top and you've spent an hour watching a train climb up a mountain, or you've come all the way around and had the whole experience. We often hear people say, "We'll see you again next year," because it was so much fun.
And at 5 miles an hour, you really do get to take everything in pretty easily as you're ascending and descending, right?
Absolutely, yes. So in the coach cars, the cool thing is as you're going up, all the seats face uphill, and then as you're going down, we turn them all around, and they all face downhill. So you always have that front-looking view.
Oh, I love it. All right, and how about protocols because of the pandemic, Rob?
So we're following as much as we can through the CDC and stuff like, all the safety measures we can, a lot of cleaning here in the buildings. But right now, I'd probably say about over 50% of the people riding the train are masked, but there isn't anything saying they have to be.
All right. And then for tickets, you make it pretty easy on the website. Explain the process there.
Yeah. So you go right on thecog.com and you can buy, pick your day and your time, and it's a pretty simple process.
I think you can even pick your seat, right?
Yeah, absolutely can. Absolutely.
It's fantastic. Rob Airey is the director of marketing for the Mount Washington Cog Railway, or as if locals would call it, the Cog, and it's now running all winter. You can learn more at thecog.com. Rob, I want to thank you so much for sharing this, the wonder of the Cog Railway, with us this morning. It's been a lot of fun.
That's for sure. Now we need to get you over here, Rick.
No doubt about it. I have a friend who comes up to... just on the other side he is, so I'm thinking when he comes up from Mass, we're going to have to get together and ride it on up. So should be a lot of fun.
We look forward to hosting you.
All right, thanks. We're going to take a break for a top-of-the-hour CBS News update, and then we'll talk to Rusty. And a reminder that coming up this morning at 11, it's Common Sense Radio, followed by the Midday News Service. Followed by the Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference today on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I love doing this show, but I've got to admit that it gives me special joy when Danny types onto the screen that we have a call from Rusty. No town, no last name needed. He's one of the few people in the state, like Bernie, who need no surname, no introduction. And he joins us now because he's about to embark on a winter tour of the state with a show this Friday in Bradford. Rusty, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint as a guest and not a caller.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
Oh, we love having you. Listeners, to ask Rusty DeWeese about his upcoming shows or about the meaning of life, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. What will people get to enjoy on the Rusty DeWeese winter tour, the loggers down from the mountain?
First thing they enjoy, Rick, at the Lager Show as I'm going around the state is each other.
Oh.
You know, anyone who has it in their mind to, okay, I'm okay, Joe, okay, Susie, let's head out down the road to the Bradford Academy 12 miles, even if Roger Hill is forecasting snow 5-6 days ahead. Let's head down. And who we're going to see? Going to see neighbors there. And that's the most important thing. And then I'm going to try to make them laugh and tap their toes in the meantime. So that's in a nutshell, that's it, Rick.
Yeah, I forget that we haven't been around other people. I hope we know how to behave. Who's going to be performing with you, Rusty?
In Bradford, I have three of the shows. Bradford, Patrick Ross, who's an extraordinary fiddle player, musician, and mandolin player, and actually very good on stage. He actually lives in Newbury with his wife and daughter. Ooh. And so he'll come down the road 6 miles and play fiddle. And then Newport, New Hampshire Opera House, he'll be along on that one. That's in March. And Higher Ground is February 25th. That's the big room in Higher Ground. And Patrick Ross will be there with me, too. And we're going to be rehearsing a couple times this week and tightening it all up. So can't wait, really.
Does he know what he's getting into playing with you, Rusty?
Been doing it for a decade with Patrick.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, Don Como, a lifelong friend, started out with me for about 15 years, and he and his wife Peaches went along, and then they got to getting grandkids coming up around, so they said they didn't want to be spending Friday and Saturday night stopping at Cumberland Farms at 12 a.m., you know, 12 in the morning. So they said they're all done, and I was, lightning struck in a bottle and found Patrick Ross. So it's a lot of fun, yeah.
So stopping at the Cumbies at midnight on a Friday, that's the life of the Lager on tour?
Never wanted much out of life, Rick. I just basically wanted to drive around. And honestly, so right now, I grew up in Stowe, Vermont since 1968, and I live in Elmore now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sitting on the side of the road, not driving. Right in front of the Stowe Community Church, which steeple is the highest in the state. It's 171 feet. I believe the spire at the Ira Allen Chapel is higher, but it's a spire. It's not a steeple. Now, when I hang up from you, I drive up to Morrisville and get a sandwich at the flower shop and see the gang there. Yeah. And I head up through Wolcott and Hardwick, all the while putting up posters for my Barton show, February 12th. Then I'll head into Barton. I'll see the gals and the guys in the town clerk's office. We'll have a good old time, and I'll come down in Greensboro and put up posters. I just drive around. That's what I do.
So you're on tour now, letting people know that you're on tour.
That's exactly it. It beats working. You know, Bradford's the 5th. That's next Saturday. And then Barton, Higher Ground, Bellows Falls, Virgins, St. Albans, Waterbury Center for two shows at the Cultural Center, Chelsea and Newport, New Hampshire. So that's like 9-10 shows because I'm doing two at Waterbury. So I have a good job. It's a fun, but it's been on temporary hold for the indoor shows, like you were saying. So this is, I don't know, Rick, how many people are going to show up or how many people are going to venture out and risk it. So we'll see. Well, I don't think they're risking anything. But anyway, we'll see.
Well, how much do you love getting to play at halls, at Granges, and high schools throughout Vermont, Rusty?
When I say, Rick, that all I wanted to do is drive around, that's the truth. And when I was a kid doing plays at the high school and then at the Hyde Park Opera House, Lamoille County Players, and you'd sign your name on the back of the flats, and you'd put the date, the year, and what part you played in Annie Get Your Gun, for instance, that was... It got into my blood. And then when I started doing the Lager, with Don Como, we'd sign our name at every little theater. And I thought, to make a life of going around to these halls, they're not all small, is the life that I wanted to have. You know, I remember growing up, my parents were different generation. Dad was born in 1911, and he was 50 when I was born. Well, they watched the Johnny Carson show, and I grew up watching Carol O'Connor and All in the Family and all those shows. And that really was why I ended up doing this type of thing. But to be able to go around the best state in the world is really, I feel like I am in heaven.
Yeah.
This is heaven. I don't know what's after heaven. but I don't know. But before was life somewhere. But
that's
I have
right.
Landed in heaven, and I'm not. You know me. I'm not. You know, pulling anybody's leg.
No, I know the same. I came here from Miami, and I landed here in heaven. I was also in Annie Get Your Gun. You may remember me as Townsperson. now you're playing Friday in Bradford. What's the venue like there?
Oh my God. It's BA, the old high school, Bradford Academy. And it's got one of those, they keep this place. If Carnegie Hall could take a lesson from the folks that are running the Bradford Academy, and again, I don't jest, because it's spick and span. It's beautiful. Now, you go down behind the theater, down a stairwell, like if you're backstage, and you take one stairwell, and then you go around another left and a right and a couple, three stairwells. And you open the door, and what do you see? All them old-time Vermonters out there that are listening to the Vermont Viewpoint right now know the answer. The answer is you see the old basketball court.
Right,
you remember
course.
Those ones, Rick, where the seats were up above it, and you'd look down in? Well, that's at the Bradford Academy, you know, so it's great.
Oh, wow.
That's the venue. When I go in there, I'll go down Thursday. They have a dog. There's three like ladies in there working. There's more people working in that building every day, but they work like the town clerk and all that stuff. And you go in there, and there's a dog, Crystal. And Crystal has a dog bed in each of the ladies' offices. And I bring Crystal in a bone. This dog is the cutest dog. So yeah, come to Bradford Academy. And by the way, I think the folks know on these, I call them the tiny town hall. I call this the tiny town hall tour down from the mountain. Mm-hmm. If you show up on a tractor, lawn, garden, or farm, you get in free. One person per tractor.
I love it. Yeah, don't crowd the tractor. All right, let's go to Forbes, who's joining us. Hi, Forbes. Go right ahead.
Hi. Good morning. Hi, Rusty.
Hey, Forbes.
Do you need tickets in advance, or can you get tickets at the Academy the 5th?
Good question, Forbes. Forbes and Rick, way pre-pandemic, I decided I don't want tickets. I don't want people to have to think they're getting stuff mailed. So literally, there's a number you can call. It's 802-793-1901. It happens to be the number I'm speaking through right now. And
so
you just say, hey,
right
I'm Forbes,
now.
I'm coming. Two tickets. But you don't even have to do that. You just show up at 7 o'clock. The show's at 7:30. When I do the truck tour in the summer, I just have an old cookie jar duct taped to the back of my flatbed, and you just come and put your $20 in. And some people say, well, what if people just come and they sit there and they watch your show and they don't pay? I say, that's great. Doesn't matter.
Wow.
Anyway, so yeah, you can call, you can get on Eventbrite.
Right.
And also there's one other way to get tickets, but yeah, you just show on up.
Yeah, and if you are going to the Higher Ground show, you can go to highergroundmusic.com. But Forbes, if you want to be fancy and formal, you can call Rusty 802-793-1901 or go to Eventbrite, get tickets there, eventbrite.com, or just show up and put the money in the jar. Oh, Rusty.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. By the way, if you can get on thelogger.com, thelogger.com, go to upcoming performances. That brings you to the Google Calendar and for the Bellows Falls Opera House show, for the Higher Ground, as you mentioned, Rick, and also for Newport Opera House. You go through their website, right? Otherwise, you call my little number. Yeah.
All right. You got special tour T-shirts, posters, some serious merch for this, Rusty?
I do. The best. Well, I got all the merch there, including I still have some thongs left over. And they're left over. They're not left over, you know, because they sell good. They're the new order. And anyway,
gotcha.
I have hats and stuff.
Fresh thongs. Fresh
the
thongs.
What's that?
You got fresh thongs then.
I got fresh thongs. All different sizes. And a lot of times they just get pinned up on the wall, you know.
Of course.
Anyway, I got Lager news T-shirts with the Mack truck on the front of them. So I got Mack truck
nice.
Tour T-shirts. They're going to be there to sell. But new material, new original music. I got a song that I wrote called $11 Tomato. It's the irony. It's about the irony of the healthy food movement here in Vermont and the irony of how many people actually can afford it. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
So there's some – there's the, you listen to the stories – and the songs, and you might laugh, but you come away going, you know, he's got a point there.
You know? You got to be wealthy to be healthy.
Hey, man, can I use that? I'll send
yours.
You a check in the mail.
It's all yours.
Alliteration.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, and here comes Rusty. Sorry, many years ago when I was a freshman in college, we went to the nearby county fair in Dayton, Ohio, and they had greyhound racing at the start of every race. When the mechanical rabbit came around the track, that was the call the announcer made. And I just wanted to do that just once. It felt so appropriate this morning because Rusty DeWeese is with me for a few more minutes. We're talking about his winter schedule of shows going on across the state, ending at the end of March. And to ask Rusty a question, share a comment, you can call us 802-244-1777. 877-291-8255. Rusty, at the break, I had to read that promo about a party down at Rusty Parker Park, and I was thinking if you could just convince Elmore to create a Rusty DeWeese Park, we would forevermore hold the distinction of having the most parks named Rusty of anywhere in the world, anywhere in the country.
That's not bad. I tell you, as you well know, because I know you've covered it, Elmore's doing such great things up there with the store and saving it and getting pressure in the government to keep the postal thing up there. And there's a new young couple up there, and the town's raised some money, and they got that store going after poor Warren passed away, and Kathy's there and everything. So anyway, it's all good. But, yeah, I remember Rusty Parker. You know, growing up, that's who I was listening to. Every single morning. So,
well, I'm going to be up in Elmore March 3rd. That's part of the WDEV's 90th anniversary tour. And I'm doing stops, you know, every few weeks. That's a lot of work to sort out venues and logistics. What's it like putting together a tour with at least 10 stops in like a month and a half? That's got to be a logistical, you know, kind of logistical gymnastics for you.
There are a bit of gymnastics, and appreciate you pointing that out. The part of the job of the show business, if you're doing everything yourself, you're producing it yourself, which I got tipped off to do that from Meatloaf, you know, when I did the movie Black Dog. He said, do it yourself, you know. That's the part of the job. So, you know, I'm postering today, and then I come back at around 3 o'clock, and I'll do the ads for the Bellows Falls shows, because even though you get your tickets through Bellows Falls, I'm producing that show too. So there's about five papers down there. I'll put my ads in. So, Rick, the answer to the question is a heck of a lot easier now. I've been doing it for 25 years, and I have my template. Now, when I started out, I had to get right into the yellow pages and look for the papers and, you know, and then send the print ad in a different way and take the photo down. So it's a lot easier now to do. But it's when I started doing theater when I was young, like serious theater in Burlington, straight plays, in other words, that were dramatic, Sam Shepard and Chekhov, things like that. I marveled at the play and the work, and the people came that liked it, and you got to know the people who were in the play with you. But I was as interested as I was in the content of the play and delivering the play well. I was interested in how many people were coming.
Right.
Some of the actors and actresses would be in the dressing room doing their vocal exercises, and I'd be out the back door of the theater looking for light beams coming to come to that parking in there and go into that show to see that show. And so I had that in me too. I just followed, you know, I just put one step in front of the other and did what I felt. So that's the fun part, seeing how many people come in again. And again, because of this pandemic-y thing, this first time going in, I have no idea how many people are reading their little ads in the paper going, let's drive out and see Russ and sit close to somebody, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, and then the other thing people don't see is the coordination you have to do with all your roadies, your marketing people, your hair and makeup, your chauffeur and chaperone. I mean, that's got to be incredible, the logistics for that, Rusty.
Well, the best thing about it is all that the chaperone, the roadie, the driver, the hair and makeup, the writing team, they get paid a lot of money. And the good news is, I am all those people, so I'm the only one that I pay. You know? But Patrick, of course, Patrick gets paid, and the Bradford Academy gets paid, you know, and all the print ad people get paid. But again, this is the Vermont Viewpoint way.
Yeah, right.
Jim Douglas, you know, the Vermont way was the name of his book, which is a great book. I recommend it. Is to do it yourself, And why do you do it yourself? Because it's so dang enjoyable to go up and see the gals and the guys in the town clerk's office and the guys shoveling the snow and then the people coming after this. I mean, cripes almighty. Most of the people that come to shows now are actually friends. You know, we do Christmas cards and everything. And it can be done in Vermont for many reasons. I think one of the main reasons is it's so small, Rick.
Yeah. Have you ever, I doubt it, but have you ever had stage fright?
Well, yeah, when I was a kid, you know, people say that all the time. Do you get nervous? And I say here, this is the answer to that question is, I don't think I get nervous the way the folks are asking, like in the sense that they're asking it. Mm-hmm. Do I get those nerves where your stomach's weird and everything?
Yeah.
But, you know, leading up to the show in Bradford, it's not anxiety, but there's an anxiousness of, is it going to work? Do I have the routines at the tip of my tongue the way they were at the end of the last tour 2 years ago? You know, because you have to do this stuff. It's like a muscle. You have to do it to get it at your fingertips, at the tip of your tongue. So am I sure I'm going to hit that stage and give the best product? Are Patrick and I going to hit the harmonies? So I go into every show, even if it's two people in a nursing home sitting there who have Alzheimer's, and I don't say that as a joke. They have Alzheimer's. I'm not sure it's going to work. So there's an apprehension. There's an anxiety. So it's not nerves like you're thinking, I got to go to the bathroom and maybe, you know,
right,
throw up or something.
Right. Yeah, that's the other thing. You do have to be on. You have to be funny. You have to be entertaining for people. What does get you excited about performing in front of an audience?
I think it is now. It is the fact that, you know, it always was. I remember, here's the answer, but I'll harken back. Right. One of the first shows I did at the town hall in Stowe, we used to call it something, Memorial Building. I remember the lager was brand new, and I produced myself, and there was an intermission. And I looked out the curtain during intermission, and this will be blatant. This will be maybe a little rough for people to take, but I saw one of the richest guys in town standing up in the back. You know, I sell cider and donuts. This is during the intermission. I saw one of the richest guys in town chatting with one of the poorest guys in town. And they were sharing cider and donut. And so I go, that is the biggest thrill. No, it's not thrill. That is the most value, I think, that I feel when I go home and go to bed, and I feel that the show offers, which was actually by accident, the answer to the first question you asked, what will people get? What will people see? They will see each other. So that's the answer to that question.
Boy, I forget that there was LBL, because I've been here for 19 years. There's always been lager, but life before lager, what was it like the first time you trotted out the lager in front of, was it a Vermont crowd? And did they give you strange looks, or did they get it right away and just chime in with laughter and support?
To the contrary, I did a couple of the stories in for little groups. Actually, I was in New York City working at William Doyle Galleries and doing movies and TV and stuff, and I was just wrote to stuff. So the biggest coming out party was your good friend, and everyone's good friend, George Woodard, was doing starting out the Groundhog Opera. He said, Russ, I said, George, I got a couple stories. Could I do them? And it was at the old Waterbury Elementary there, right near your studio. And he said, yeah. So I did two stories there, and the people really took to them. I had listened to Marshall Dodge as a kid, and it wasn't the first time I was on stage, so I knew how to present stuff, and people liked them. And then I remember I wanted to do First Night, and then I did. They accepted me at First Night, even though there's some cussing, rated SC, some cussing. And Jimmy Swift said, yeah, how many shows you want? I said, five. So those were real nerves back then, Rick, because now I was taking these stories that Waterbury and Waterbury Center people really, really responded to. And I'm going to city people, Burlington people, and all, you know, all ages. And they liked it too. So right away, the first stuff I wrote was pretty strong, and it was like a play. So it was, and then I was able to say to myself, you know what? I don't think I'll put this lager cap up into the mothballs in the attic. I think I'll just keep going with it. And I did, and people have been coming out. So it's just like anybody's job, electrician or your job or plumber or kitchen helper or dishwasher. It's just a job, and you do it.
Yeah. Now, it's rated SC, some cussing. So how family-friendly are your shows?
On the poster, it says, for the whole family, ... almost. I can tell you this right now. People throughout the years who know of me, they bring their 8-year-old kids or 7-year-old kids, and the kids sit there and laugh. And it's cussing that they might hear the uncle say around the Thanksgiving table. I don't do the vulgarity. It's also, you know, you be your judge. If I had an 8-year-old kid, would I bring he or her to the show? You're darn right I would. But it's also rated NZ, not Zoom. I mean, this is live. You're going to smell me. You're going to get a little – well, no, I shouldn't say that. I was going to say you might get a little spray from my voice, but you won't. You'll be sitting far enough back that you won't get – and by the way, the guideline thing, it's like, believe it or not, Bradford Academy doesn't have any guidelines. Hmm. I go in there like 3 months ago to rent a place. I said, what are your guidelines? And the ladies look up to me and they go, we don't have them. So on my poster it says mask equals entry. And so that's what we'll do, and we'll see how it works.
All right. Do you have a special winter wardrobe for this tour, Rusty?
For this tour? No. The thing about doing the lager in the winter is I wear my longies to the theater. I set the theater up, and then before the people start showing up, when they show up early, you know, because they're not real theater goers. They're people that are like, they don't go to the theater much, so they get there really early. So they want to see. So, and then we chat and we have a good time. But I take my long johns off and I do the show without the long johns. But that's the only difference. You know, that's the wardrobe thing.
Yeah. We got about 30 seconds. Any town or venue in the state that you haven't played that you're just jonesing to sometime?
Sure there are. Again, 30 seconds. What would they be? I mean, I've hit every corner. So there's several towns. I will say Chelsea is on this tour. So I haven't played the Chelsea Hall. That's going to be good. But no, yeah. There are plenty I'd like to play and will play. And I appreciate the time on your station. And have a good rest of the winter, everybody listening.
All right, you too. Boy, I love Chelsea with those two beautiful town greens. Jerry Greenfield of Ben & Jerry said, Rusty DeWeese is a legend in Vermont, and he doesn't even make ice cream. Imagine that. That is saying something. Rusty, folks, first, you can go to thelager.com, learn about tickets, or you can call 802-793-1901. Rusty, thanks so much for being on the show this morning.
Thanks a lot, Rick. I'll be listening to you as I put up posters.
All right. Good. Have fun. All right. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update. Then we'll be back to talk about what it's like to see narwhals in the Arctic. And coming up today at 4, we've got the afternoon news service with Brady Farkas, followed by the Brady Farkas Show, followed by Jazz with George Thomas. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Well, right now we're supposed to be talking about narwhals, but we aren't able to reach our guest. Looks like we can't make a call to Canada right now. So until maybe we hear from Isabel Grock, we will open the phones up at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Isabel Grock is a conservation photographer, and she is going to be putting on a really interesting presentation tomorrow. It's part of the North Branch Nature Center's program. It's going to be called Stories from the Field with Isabel Grock. She is an interesting cat, documentary filmmaker, writer, conservation photographer, and she's also an urban planner, quite a dual career, but we still hope to have her on this hour to talk to her about that. But anyway, to let you know about her her presentation tomorrow, it is from 6 to 7, and if you go to northbranchnaturecenter.org, You'll be able to see it tomorrow from 6 to 7, and it is free, and it will be Zoomed. She's out in Vancouver, B.C. Very interesting woman, has done some great things, and, of course, I'm excited because she's seen narwhals in the wild. It was one of the things she went and was able to photograph. And she does some neat things to help protect the lesser-known threatened species on the planet. And I was hoping we'd be able to talk to her about that. So it's possible we'll hear from Isabel Grock this morning, the conservation photographer. Might be an E6 on us this time. But anyway, phones are open right now, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. I guess I should update you on my spare ribs versus short ribs situation. So got a great recipe for hoisin, short ribs, and I made it with spare ribs because I was at the Von Trapp farm stand, and they had the spare ribs, which are pork rather than the beef, which are short ribs, and made them on Friday night, and they were delicious, and spare ribs work just fine. You know, you use a Dutch oven and cook it in there for about 2.5 hours, and oh my, it just was outstanding. Fall off the bone. You know, those Dutch ovens are just so great. My sister convinced me I needed one, and I have used it on several occasions, and it's really great. So anyway, that's what I made over the weekend. What else did I make? I made some nice sausage lately, and the green vegetable curry last week. Yeah, I've been doing a little cooking. All right, we are at 802-244-1777 or also 877-291-8255. All right. I just got an email back from our guest, but it looks like we might be in for a little trouble here. Okay. Let's see. We did hear from Charlie during Charlie Taplin, and he says hello to Rusty. He says, I've known Rusty when we were just youngsters. how about that? At some point, we were indeed youngsters. All right. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. All right, we have our guest, and she has a master's in city planning from MIT. And as much as you're all dying to discuss urban planning with her this morning, I'm not going to do that. Isabel Grock is also a writer, documentary filmmaker, conservation photographer focused on environmental science, wildlife, natural history, and conservation. Tomorrow night, she will be sharing that side of her dual career with anyone who tunes into her presentation that's brought to you through the North Branch Nature Center. And that's what we're going to be talking about. Isabel Grock, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks.
Now, does your wildest day as an urban planner ever come close to equal a day out as a photographer, photographing wildlife?
It's a great question, Rick. Actually, I didn't start as an urban planner. I started as a photojournalist. It's something I've always wanted to do since I was a young age. Mm-hmm. I grew up in France. And when I was about 9 years old, I was watching television with my parents, and there was news of a massive oil spill that had affected the coast of Brittany. And I saw those images of the birds covered in oil, suffering, dying. And that made a profound impact on me at that young age. They were calling out for volunteers to clean up the beaches in Brittany and help the birds. I said to my parents, I want to go. You know what my parents said. No, you're staying in school. And it's it's interesting because it was a pivotal moment for me because I was living far from the ocean in a city in the middle of France, in the southwest of France. I'd never seen a seabird. I'd never been to Brittany. Yet I was devastated by what I was seeing, this environmental disaster. I wanted to help. So I thought, wow, this is what I want to do. Like, when I grow up, I want to use writing and photography to document the plight of these species and around the world. Mm-hmm. So I finally went to school. I went to Columbia University, where I did a degree in journalism and specialized in photojournalism. And now, while I was there, I reported on quite a bit on the Bronx and other areas as well. And so that intrigued me, and that's what led me to urban planning as well. So I did do a degree in urban planning. But that affair with passion for wildlife and saving wildlife really stayed with me. And I suppose I bring in my dual background in journalism and urban planning to look at how that interface between humans and us, our impact of the human population and the loss of habitat on wildlife, and how can we coexist together. So I guess I use a bit of my urban planning lens when I'm out in the field, because when I document and photograph all these different species in different habitats, you see the human footprints as being one of the primary threats to these animals that I've been documenting over the years.
I got it. What will you be sharing with people tomorrow evening during the Zoom presentation you're doing?
I'm very excited by this event because I will be sharing what it's like to be a conservation photographer. So I'll be sharing stories from the field, a little bit about my background and how I got started, and also how I choose projects, what species I'm interested in, and how I go about it. So I'll share stories of going in the Canadian Arctic and the freezing waters, documenting researchers who were trying to capture narwhal to put satellite transmitters on them. I'll share stories of being in the mountains of British Columbia's snow-whipped ridges, searching for the endangered mountain caribou, and documenting another project of people involved in trying to save the last mountain caribou of British Columbia. And also I'll talk about species close to home and what does it look like to document conservation in your backyard. And here I'm really hoping to share messages of hope as well, because in the face of habitat destruction, wildlife extinction, how can you take action? And I think photography and storytelling has this power of getting people to be interested in the environment, the animals, and trying to help them from where you are, wherever you are.
Now, I promise, Isabel, I'll talk about other things, but I have a love affair with the narwhal, and I think you're the first person I've ever spoken with who's actually ever seen one. First of all, like you said, pictures, film of narwhals, it's incredible when you first actually see one. Describe them for someone who's never seen a narwhal.
Yes, it's interesting because people have this fascination for what is probably one of the strangest creatures that on the planet. You know, narwhal has this, as you know, they have these tusks, and those tusks can be 10 feet long, so quite massive. And they live in these ice environment. They spend 9 months out of 12 in the heart of darkness, navigating the packed ice and looking for the small holes and leads to come up for air. So they're incredibly adapted to life, to the ice. And they've been named as a sea unicorn, and you know, in literature and mythology, I mean, everybody has heard of the narwhal. And I actually talked to scientists who said when they give talks about the science of narwhal and what it's like to study them in the field, many people actually come up to them thinking, wow, I actually didn't know they existed.
Right.
People still have that trouble thinking that, well, the narwhal, they exist. And so for me, seeing them for the first time, so I was camping in on Baffin Island in a little remote area where I spent a couple of weeks with this team of researchers. So we had our tents set up, and the very first time it was in the middle of the night, and I was walking up. It's a very silent environment, obviously, and you just hear the wind. And what I first heard was their breathing as they were coming. So I got up immediately and just got to listen to their breathing, actually, as they came through by our camp. So it was a pretty magical experience of just hearing them first before actually seeing them. And to me, documenting this and photographing them and learning about their threats is really important, because narwhal today symbolize one of the major climate crisis we're faced with, because they're struggling to survive today with increased shipping, increased traffic, climate, ice warming, and ice disappearing. And so it would be sad to think that people who thought, oh, well, they had trouble understanding this species existed, and that's today, with all the threats they're facing, they may slip into extinction. So it's very important to tell people, for me at least, well, they're real, this is what they do, and they're magic, and also the threats they're facing. So we have this connection, even though this species is so far away from where we are, and want to help protect it.
Isabel, how do you work to raise the profile of lesser-known threatened species?
How do I work? I really look for collaborations with scientists. It's not I'm urban planner, photojournalist. I'm not a biologist. I'm not a scientist in that sense. So
right.
I really reach out to scientists. I work with them very closely to identify the species behavior, the habitat. And so that's really helps me develop a story, and being in their habitat with these scientists and really following them. That's really been really humbling for me to be able to learn from them and develop those stories. And then I tend to, you know, you can't, there's so much you can cover. There's so many stories to follow. And you may wonder, how do I choose? Where do I focus my efforts?
Right.
And so I really go with my heart. I was intrigued by the narwhal. I was intrigued by the North Atlantic right whale, which is a very endangered whale, and also by smaller species that are not as charismatic, perhaps, or that is not as well known, but has such an importance in the ecosystem. So I worked several years on a project to document toads, those little amphibian western toads.
Uh-huh.
And then people are like, why, how? You know, there's so many other charismatic species. Why the toads? And the thing about the toads, it's because people can see them. They are in people's neighborhoods, near roads. And so this is a species where you're able to connect local action and what can people do locally to help save their environment and the wildlife that live next to them. And so in the case of the toads, for example, I've learned that they were undertaking this migration every year from the wetlands where they originated to the forest. And in the middle, well, they're trying to navigate this environment. And what's in the middle of a fragmented habitat? Well, that's the urban planner's mind here. There are roads. So what do? You know, so when those amphibians cross the road to go from one habitat to the next, they get killed, sadly. So it has had an impact on the population of western toads. And what I noticed is that all these people, neighbors, residents, community residents said, oh, well, we can't let that happen. We want to do something to save these little toads. And so they got together. They tried to talk to people to use detour and not take that road. They get toad tunnels built so the toads can cross the road more safely. And so that was the impetus for me to document a little species that you look very uncharismatic, but he's actually very well loved by local people, and being able to showcase local action, and that translated for me into a documentary called Toad People that really showcases what people do to save species they love near them. And it was interesting, Rick, because, you know, it was a very local film. It was made in British Columbia, and it featured villages and rural towns in BC. And then this film was showcased internationally, and then I started receiving messages from all over the world, from people in different communities in Italy, in Switzerland, in the UK, in Australia, saying, oh, we have toads as well, and we want to save them. And we were inspired to see what people in British Columbia could do to save their local toads, and we want to do the same. So it was a local story that had global appeal, if you will. So, and today, in this day and age, being able to connect the local to the global is very powerful, because it really gives a message to people around the world when they want to do something and they feel demoralized by the extinction crisis, the climate crisis, the biodiversity loss we're experiencing, and they feel, what can we do? What can we do? And then there's ways you can make impact locally and be connected to a larger movement.
That's Isabel Grock, a conservation photographer, and we'll get to not only hear but see her outstanding work tomorrow night. It's from 6 to 7 in a presentation called Stories from the Field with Isabel Grock, and you can go to northbranchnaturecenter.org, learn how to see it. It's free, and it's going to be wonderful. Isabel, you've got me inspired. I can't wait to see you tomorrow night. Thank you so much for being on with us this morning.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.
All right, take care. We love the toad now, too, as much as the narwhal.
Glad you do.
Good. All right, that's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan. Feel free to suggest guests or topics by emailing vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. And the podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store. Funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sarah is up next. That's followed by the governor's COVID-19 response news conference. And that's right after CBS News in the noon hour. I'm Rick Sengary. Meet you back here tomorrow when we talk about the School for International Training in Brattleboro. We'll meet the Bennington Martins, and we hear from Kat Wright and our own Lee Cattell.